Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Kyle Duncan for the appellants, Belmont Abbey College and Wheaton College. Colleges challenge a final agency rule. The HHS mandate is a violation of their religious liberty. The lower courts dismissed their cases as lacking standing and rightness, but the real issue here is mootness. The government cannot moot these.
If we agreed with you and we sent this back to the district court, what would you challenge there? What would be the nature of your challenge?
We would continue seeking injunctive relief against the regulatory.
But HHS has said there's going to be a new rule no later than August 2013. Why don't you wait to see what that rule looks like? You don't know what the target is.
Right. We are challenging the final mandate that's been on the books for 16 months in the Code of Federal
Regulations. But the government has said that's going to change.
The government has simply solicited ideas and questions.
No, they haven't. In their final rule, they said by the end of the safe harbor period, they would have new rules.
The ANPRM that you're referring to, Your Honor, is merely a solicitation.
No, I'm not referring to that. I'm referring to the final rule. During the temporary enforcement safe harbor, the department's plan to develop and propose changes to these final regulations that would meet two goals. During the safe harbor, that's what they're going to be doing. They're going to be coming up with new rules.
Your Honor, during that, the government has said that they intend to do that. All that means is they have promised to engage in a future rulemaking. They have not issued a notice of proposed rulemaking.
Not yet. We'll talk to them about that.
They've issued an advance notice. Right. The advance notice doesn't do anything to change the final mandate that is effective now.
Except it tells us there will be a new regime. There will be a new rules. Challenge those. The rules that you have right now, the government has said repeatedly that they're going to be changed.
Simply, the government's saying that they may change something in the future. It's not a binding promise. It's nothing like in the API case, in the American Petroleum case, where the government was bound to come out with a final rule by a date certain and had already published.
Not a particular final rule, right? That they issued a notice of proposed rulemaking, but that doesn't change. When you issue a notice of proposed, even as compared to what they've done in this case, it doesn't vacate the existing rule.
No, it
doesn't guarantee that the rule be issued. And it didn't in that case. All they agreed in that case was that they would do something by a date, but they were not bound to issue that particular rule that they proposed by that date, right?
That's true, but the proposed rule in API was very specific. It was something that you could compare to the
two. The industry was going to get the relief they wanted.
That's correct.
Right.
Exactly.
There was no question about
that. There was no question about that.
That's different than this case.
That is different than this case. And notice, in that, that's a weaker case.
But it's a stronger case, I think. Well, depending on what you're saying. But here, and now I'm, again, once again, reading from the final rule, the department will work with stakeholders to propose and finalize this policy before the end of the temporary enforcement safe harbor. The government has said there's going to be a new law. So why in the world would we let this lawsuit go forward attacking a law that the government itself says is not going to be around in a little while?
Because there is a final rule that is impacting the college's religious freedom, budgeting, planning, academic hiring, and exposing them voluntarily. The government has voluntarily exposed the colleges to be subject to private lawsuits under ERISA under the current final rule. And in Chamber of Commerce versus FEC,
the ERISA lawsuits, that's highly speculative, isn't it? I mean, we know that it's not going to happen from folks at Belmont Abbey College, right?
We don't know that, Your Honor. The Belmont Abbey has suffered EEOC actions through its own employees. But that doesn't matter, because this court in Chamber of Commerce versus FEC said it gave four reasons to find standing in a very similar situation. It said, if you have a legal norm that is constraining your conduct right now, which we have here, that's enough for standing. And then it said, if you subject parties to the threat of private lawsuits, it didn't say whether the lawsuits were speculative or not. You can't know that.
So it goes back to the district court. You challenge it. and then the law changes.
Then we amend our pleadings, Your Honor. We amend it. We do the same thing we did when they came out with the safe harbor and the ANPRM. We amend our pleadings. We don't know what the government's going to do. The government won't say what it's going to do. Your Honor just read specific things. The government will not bind itself to those specific things. All it says is it's soliciting ideas and questions.
We'll hear from the government. I think they've made a stronger representation than you have. But they have told us, they've given us the parameters for what the new rule is going to look like, right? I mean, there are some limits to it. And I take it the part that you object to most is that they have not allowed for the possibility that your clients will be exempt, right? Is that the gravamen of are you saying that even after this new rule comes in place, they've already announced that it's not going to benefit us in the way that is significant to us?
Well, it certainly seems that way from the ANPRM, but we predict the government will say, well, anything's on the table. Well, anything may be on the table. We have no idea what's coming out.
Your point is that there is no binding commitment on the part of the government to do anything.
That is correct.
There's only, and it's only the weakest form of notice, an advance notice of rulemaking, not even a notice of rulemaking. And you, not only that, but you have no binding commitment that you're going to get a final rule. It's just this is the government's intention, and they could have done it in a press release.
That is exactly right. That is exactly right. And I might add, if it is truly the government's intention that these rules will never apply to the colleges, then the government should enter into a consent decree with us right now, which we invited them to do in negotiations in this case. The government would not do so.
That's not how I read what they've said. They haven't promised that much. But what they have promised is that it's going to change.
Your Honor, in this case, you've all
how
seen.
They promise it. They put it in a rule. That's going to change.
They've put it in an advance notice of proposed rulemaking. Let me put it this way.
You keep saying that. I haven't even picked up the advance notice of proposed rulemaking yet. Everything that I've read to you from is from the final rule.
That is a reference to the ANPRM that is issued on March 21st, 2012, Your Honor.
No, it's not. It's February 15th, 2012. That's what I've been reading from.
Right.
And they say it's going to change. They even give the parameters of the change. They give us a general sense of what the new rule is going to look like.
Your Honor, let me put it this way. If we had, in order to come within shouting distance of APO, the only case they have that shows you can render tentative a already final rule that's been published in this book, in the Code of Federal Regulations for 16 months, that the government is already litigating on the merits in 10 cases around the country, including in this courthouse. The only way to come within shouting distance of API is to have a proposed rulemaking that says two things. We will rescind the mandate, or we will expand the exemption to you. Then you are within shouting distance
of
API.
Well, there's another way, and in fact, neither party cites it, but there is a Supreme Court case called EPA versus Brown, and it's 431 U.S. 99. And in that case, there were regulations outstanding, and the Solicitor General's office made a representation to the Supreme Court that we're going to change these regulations. And the Supreme Court vacated four Court of Appeals decisions that had struck down the regulations and sent the cases back, for a consideration of mootness. But there's one essential difference between EPA versus Brown and the position of the government in this case. In the EPA case in the Supreme Court, the government confessed error and said the regulations were invalid. So given that confession of error, they couldn't be enforced. And that's an essential difference because I don't see anything in the government's presentation here that says that the regulations that you're attacking are invalid unless they're altered.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Absolutely not. And that, you said mootness. If this is a mootness case, and it is, then consider the government's burden to show it's absolutely clear that the wrongful conduct will not recur. That the government cannot make that showing by temporarily sustaining CSI Aviation.
We should focus on whether it's a ripeness case. I can't speak for my colleagues, but I think I agree with you that this is both on mootness and standing. Those are the wrong doctrines. So at least for my purposes, it will be help if you focus on ripeness.
Okay, so let's think about ripeness this way. It is finality and hardship, of course. So suppose that
it's not finality and hardship, it's fitness.
Fitness.
And, hardship. And in toilet goods, for example, the Supreme Court held, even where it was final, even where the only issue was legal, it still might not be fit. So
very well, Your Honor. It's fitness, which is whether it's a legal challenge, purely legal challenge, which this is. The government agrees that it is. 99% of it is. Finality, plus hardship.
No. Hardship is a separate doctrine. Fitness is one. Hardship is a second requirement.
Okay.
But the essence we've said of the fitness issue is, I'm going to quote this because we appear to like this language. If we do not decide the issue now, we may never need to decide the issue. It's a sort of a classic description of the doctrine of judicial restraint. And if the government comes out with another regulation, which they say they will do, now, I appreciate it. They can't be bound to it, but they couldn't be bound to it in API.
They were bound to it in API.
No, they were bound, just to be clear, they were bound to reach a result, but they were not bound to reach that result. Otherwise, they could not have issued a notice of proposed rulemaking. They would have had to issue a final rule.
Well, that's true, but they were bound to do that by a settlement agreement with the Sierra.
No, but the settlement...
Was that reduced to a judgment, the settlement agreement?
I'm not aware that it was, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that.
The settlement agreement was a timing question. The settlement agreement was that they would do something by a certain time, not that they had to issue that particular regulation.
Okay, I don't know that the case is that specific, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that.
For example, in the I'm just trying to get the acronym right, UARG and the AT&T, all those are cases where there was a notice, unlike here where there was an advance notice. But a notice doesn't eliminate the finality of the previous rule either.
Absolutely not.
Right. Neither a notice nor an advance notice. And yet, in all three of those cases, the court said, relying on this principle of judicial restraint, that maybe we won't have to decide this complicated constitutional issue at all if we don't decide it now. And that's the question of fitness.
Okay. So let's take, first of all, let's remember that in API, all the court did is hold it in abeyance.
I take your point here. And you have a very nice point in your reply brief, which points out that that's not what the district court did. So I take that as being a possible alternative suggestion, that what we do is remand the case to the district court, tell the district court not to actually dismiss the case, but to hold it in abeyance.
But we don't think you should do that, Your Honor, because
that is what you said. That is sort of your fallback position in your reply.
We don't call it a fallback position. Our case is stronger for ripeness than API.
When you pointed this out to me about API, that's what you were saying. In API,
we can't get a stronger result here on a weaker case, is what we said in our brief, right? But consider this. The government hasn't even come within shouting distance of API. They have only issued an advance notice. That is not even the beginning of a rulemaking.
This advance notice actually specifies the precise wording of the rule that they're contemplating, right? The exact words.
Well, it does, but when we talk about it, the government says anything's on the table. It refuses to allow itself to be bound by anything. Let's imagine this. Let's imagine that there's a proposed rulemaking. I say I'm in a rebuttal time, but let's imagine...
It's going to take longer. I can tell you already.
I fear you're right. Let's imagine a notice of proposed rulemaking, an actual notice of proposed rulemaking that comes with an API. So now we're within API. Let's imagine that it's just for the... We're not challenging that, right? We're not challenging the APRM. We're not challenging... Let's imagine a notice of proposed rulemaking that actually tracks those suggestions. Well, then we amend our pleadings and go forward because it doesn't even solve the problem. Now, we amend our pleadings and go forward with the same claims that we have now because it doesn't even solve the problem.
Right, but there are different problems, right? You can't challenge a notice of proposed rulemaking either until it becomes final, right?
Which we wouldn't be doing.
Right. So here let's jump ahead a little bit. We'll have to go back to fitness in a minute, but on the hardship question.
Okay, hardship.
Your bottom line point is, which you just made, is that you have a religious objection even to their proposed rule, right?
Well, if that turned out to be
the rule, you would have a religious objection.
Same objection.
Well, you would have the same objection, but the legal analysis would be different. And we can't consider that rule until it is a rule. You at least give me that, right?
Yes, and we're not challenging that. Of course, it doesn't exist, but we're not challenging it.
Right. So if we tell the district court that the district court must rule on the present rule, and then they do adopt what they say, that decision of the district court will then be moot, will be vacated, and there will be a new rule, and it will have to start over on that.
Why couldn't we ask the district court to amend, to use its equitable powers and change the injunction to account for a new rule that comes out in the future?
Because that is the classic advisory opinion.
Well,
a new rule that's going to come out in the future. This is what judicial restraint is all about. This is why Article 3 says only cases and controversies.
But, Your Honor,
we try to avoid getting involved in, I mean, there's a political accommodation or dispute or any other way you want to describe it between the parties here. We try to avoid getting judges into that until necessary.
May I answer, Your Honor?
Yes, of course.
Your Honor, this is a final rule that has been in this book for 16 months. Two separate comment periods. Okay, the departments have refused to either change the contents of the mandate, to change the exemption, to even offer a full safe harbor during the safe harbor period because we're still exposed to private lawsuits. The idea that the departments can thwart judicial review and make a mootness point by simply saying, well, look, we promised.
Well, I think you have the mootness point.
Well, you're missing, it seems to me, one essential consideration here. The gist or the main thrust of the complaints, as I read them, is First Amendment.
Exactly.
It is black letter First Amendment law that you consider, unlike any other area of constitutional law that I'm aware of, that you consider not only the parties, but the possible chilling effect that the particular provision you're attacking is having on other people that are similarly situated.
Absolutely, Your
Honor. And so what happens in First Amendment freedom of speech and freedom of religion cases is that you take that into account and in determining the standing and the ripeness and the mootness, all of those considerations. None of that do I see in anything that the district courts.
Absolutely not. Right. The district court completely, as a matter of fact, the district court suggested that because the colleges are sticking by their faith, in other words, they're not caving to the government, then they cannot show a substantial burden, then it's merely, I forget the word the district court used, subjective. That is not the law.
There is a final rule, and it covers how many employers in the United States?
It's millions. Impossible to say.
Millions.
Preliminary
they may not have the fortitude that Belmont Abbey has, or Wheaton College. There may be smaller employers. There may be others similarly situated, all of whom are bending to the government's will, according to your lights, unconstitutionally at this very moment.
And keep in mind that it is the pressure on the religious belief that is the substantial burden under RFRA and under the First Amendment. What we're talking about here is standing and ripeness. As much as trifles are sufficient.
I want to ask you a couple of details about the complaint.
Very well.
Which
may I add just one thing, Judge Randolph?
Yeah.
Everything that you're saying was said by this court in Chamber of Commerce versus FEC in a First Amendment case.
Yeah.
That's a speech case. But the court said you have a legal norm, right, that is influencing people's conduct. The commission couldn't enforce it at the time because they were split. And then the court said you can have standing on that basis alone.
Yeah,
and then the court said private lawsuits, First Amendment, we are a fortiori to that case. We have an agency rule, not a statute.
There is, you know, there's an underlying assumption here, and I sense it in the district court, and I sense it in some of the arguments and the briefs. If you got a decision on the merits tomorrow, would that have any effect on the merits? If number one, the two possibilities, our court holds that the mandate as issued now is a violation of the First Amendment, would that have any impact?
Absolutely, it would have impact.
Would have an enormous impact.
It would have an enormous impact. It would have an impact on the chilling effect on the freedom of the religious freedom rights of these schools.
Right.
I mean, we have affidavits in front of this court that show the chilling effect that is going on right now. I mean, they don't know what to tell their employees.
The underlying assumption, which I didn't mention, is that it's going to take some time, and we want to save the judiciary. It's kind of the for lack of a better word, the lazy judges rule. we don't want to have to go through all this because what the heck? I mean, you know, back in the next summer, it's going to all change. But that assumes that we're going to take all this period of time.
Exactly. We could seek a permanent injunction the moment we get back. Let me, about time, Your Honor. I am.
Can I just pause on that, just on that one point?
Sure.
If we were to rule to, of course, we don't have the merits before us. Right. But if we were the district court and we had the merits before us and we decided this case immediately, that would not take the pressure off of you with respect to the rule suggested in the advance notice of proposed rulemaking. That rule, if they issue the next day or whenever they issue it, will take the place of the other one. So you still have to go ahead with whatever pressures are on you. I'm not belittling the pressures. I'm just asking whether this really changes. All this would do would be to take off the pressure of the present rule, which the government has given very strong indications in both their briefs to this court, but more importantly, in the final rule they issued, they are not going to do, and instead they're going to do something else. So all the things you talk about, which I do not in any way belittle, planning requirements, et cetera, you still have to plan for the next rule. That is, for this exemption that you don't believe is good enough.
We don't know what the it's going to be.
Well, you have a very specific description of it in the listed both in the final rule and in the advance notice of proposed rulemaking, that you will not have to offer or pay for the benefits that you self-certify are inconsistent with your religious beliefs, right?
That's what some language there says, that they will force insurance companies to offer it for free.
The secretary has given mixed messages about what is coming down the pike. There's a news release, it's not in the record, but where the secretary says, we intend to require employers that do not offer coverage of contraceptive services to provide notice to employees telling them the contraceptive services are available at sites such as community health centers, public clinics, and hospitals with income-based support. So in other words, you're going to, the rule may be simply here's, you know, tell each employee where they can go get contraceptives.
You're right, Your Honor. The departments exempted. The departments came up with an exemption with no prior notice and comment.
But I guess this doesn't really change to my question, which is this, that, what, I don't know about that press release, it's not in our record, but if it were, okay, but that obviously puts pressure on you, and that puts planning pressure on you, and yet you can't challenge a press release here. So the question is, even if the two district judges in this case gave you the relief you wanted, you would still have this pressure of their announcement in the final rule and in the advance notice and in this press release that there's going to be a different kind of pressure on you when that comes out. And whatever budgeting you have to do, you would have to do that budgeting until those two district courts again rule in your favor.
The difference is whether an Article III court can take cognizance of the case, Your Honor. Imagine this. Let me answer it this way. Suppose we had sued before the HRSA recommendation had been accepted by HHS. In other words, suppose we had sued before we actually knew what was in the mandate. Right? There was a year lag time when everybody knew kind of what was going to be in the mandate, but it wasn't official. It became official on August 1st, 2011, right? We understand there's the statute and then there's the regulation. Imagine we had sued during that interim period, not ripe, right, for the reasons that Your Honor is suggesting, but we waited until after the final rule was published in the Code of Federal Regulations. I have to say, it is black letter law that a court can take cognizance, an Article III court, can review the legality of a final agency rule, and saying that we're going to revise it in the future doesn't make it a
except that this final rule says it's not the final rule. There's more coming. Now, I thought maybe I'm misunderstanding your argument. So can I
yes.
See what I understand your argument to be, and then you correct me, because I may be misunderstanding. I thought that your argument was that regardless of the particular contours of the final rule, that the government has already announced that it will be in a form that is, in fact, continuing to be objectionable because you don't get the exemption that is now provided for churches.
That is not our...
That's not. That's
I'm sorry.
Not,
that is not our argument, Your Honor. We are challenging a final rule. No one can know what is coming out of this ANPRM. That's not even a proposed rule yet.
You're not challenging. I mean,
we're not challenging that. I mean,
not only that. You're not challenging the preamble to the final rule either. The rules are what
we're challenging. This
you're challenging that. Challenging There's this. Nothing in there that says that we're going to do something different in the future.
Absolutely not.
Where I was headed with that was I thought it was going to be helpful to you, but maybe not.
Okay.
I'm not arguing your case. I'm just trying to understand it. I thought the point would be that because the government has said it's going to change the rule and change it in a certain fashion, the way they've announced they're going to change it is still unacceptable in the same way that the final rule is unacceptable. Therefore, proceed, resolve the get to the merits of this case right now, because the disposition of the merits of this case right now will answer the most fundamental objection that you have to even what they've said is coming in the future.
I mean,
that is the distinction, as I understand it, trying to distinguish between churches and religious colleges, for example.
Well, I mean, I think that is a way of putting an argument. With all due respect, Your Honor, I think it's more complicated than the argument has
I
to
see.
Be.
Okay.
We are challenging final.
I think that was the argument from the Archbishop. I'm not sure.
The Archbishop in which
the
Archbishop?
The Amici brief from the Archbishop.
I think
that was part of it.
I'm not sure they're making that argument
okay,
either. I mean, take what Judge Kogan said in the Eastern District of New York, which was another Archbishop of New York case, where he said, look, we have to treat this as if you have a rule, the one in this book here, and we have legal challenges to that rule. The ANPRM, which, with all due respect, Your Honor, is a separate promise of rulemaking. It is not part of the final rule. The final rule, which is in this book, the ANPRM is separate from it. Judge Kogan said, look, this thing doesn't change the landscape. It doesn't change policy. All it is a solicitation of ideas and questions. When pressed, I invite the court to press the government on what the substance of this new rule is going to be. When we have done so, the government has said, well, we have certain proposals, but anything's on the table.
We've seen case after case in this circuit where Congress itself orders an agency to promulgate rules by a date certain. And the date passes, and a year goes by, and 2 years goes by, and 3 years goes by. And then we have cases where the inaction of the agency is subject to judicial review because the APA says so, and we have complicated formulas to determine that. But the fact that an agency itself, without direction from Congress and without an injunction or a settlement agreement, says we're going to change it, it is not binding in any way, shape, or form on that agency.
It is not, Your Honor. And if the CSI aviation opinion says when an agency acts that way, it doesn't lessen harm, it increases it. It makes the uncertainty even more intolerable.
I want to ask you a couple of details.
Go ahead.
It struck me as odd that we have two colleges bringing essentially the same challenge before two different district judges. And can you explain why that is?
Right, Your Honor.
Why these cases were not consolidated together and before one district judge?
Belmont Abbey was brought first. When we brought Wheaton, we noted that there's a similar case in the district court, but Wheaton was procedurally different. Wheaton didn't even qualify for the safe harbor when the case was brought. That's why we sought a preliminary injunction. I hope this is clear. When Wheaton brought its lawsuit, it did not qualify for the safe harbor guidance document. The government changed the safe harbor in immediate direct response to the lawsuit, which Judge Chauvel recognized below. In other words, there was a safe harbor, which is inadequate, then it expanded.
I got it.
That's why they're not.
Is it accurate to say that Belmont Abbey objects to all the forms of contraception
correct.
That are required to be included in these plans?
That's correct.
Whereas Wheaton does not?
Yes, Wheaton objects only to certain abortion-causing contraceptives, such as Plan B and the morning after, week after pill. It has a narrower objection.
Okay, that brings me to my next question. One of the counts of your of both parties' complaints charged that not a First Amendment argument, but an argument that, for lack of a better word, the STUPAC amendment to the Affordable Care Act
violates existing law,
which says we're not going to allow, we're not going to require abortion services in any plan.
That's correct.
Right?
And the Weldon Amendment as well, we allege that.
Well, I'll put the Weldon Amendment aside for the moment. What I'm not clear about is that is there anything in the administrative record to establish that the pills that you just mentioned cause abortions?
Nothing that I know of in the administrative record, Your Honor, but in the FDA birth control guide that's published on the internet, it says these particular drugs, it terms them emergency contraceptives, may act by preventing implantation in the womb. And so
that's your definition of abortion?
For Wheaton College, that's the that's what their religious faith tells them an abortion is that you have a fertilized egg, that's this very small human being, prevents
implantation. Abortion is not defined in the statute, is it?
I'm not aware that it is, Your Honor.
Okay.
But we have an argument that it violates the APA because it includes that funding.
But that only applies to the morning after and the week after pills.
And certain intrauterine devices, that's right.
We'll give you more time, I'm sorry, but it's an important case, so we spend more time on it.
So should I sit now?
I'll put it this way. If you want a rebuttal, I would sit now.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The departments are presently addressing the concerns like those raised here.
Where's the new rule? When's it coming? What's it going to say?
Sure.
You've had six months since the close of the comment period. 6 months. So where is it?
So, Your Honor, I'll give you the two-second answer and then kind of explain a little more detail. The two-second answer is everything is going according to schedule. The slightly longer version of that answer is, obviously, as Your Honor indicated in the February 15th rule, and then again in the ANPRM, which was issued, the department stated that they will finalize the amendments.
Your terminology is wrong. The department didn't say in the February rule that it was going to change anything. It said it in the preamble.
Your Honor, I believe that at least in the Federal Registry section in which that February 15th rule was contained, and then in the ANPRN, the department said that they will finalize amendments to the regulations.
What's the citation to that in the CFR?
I don't have the CFR. I apologize. I do have the FR.
It's not in the CFR.
Citation, if you're interested.
It's not in the CFR. It's in the preamble.
It was in, at the very least, the published form in which that rule was released in February 15th, as well as in the ANPRM. And Judge Griffith, if I could just then explain what's been happening since to further answer your question. First of all, in various forms of litigation and status reports that the government has been submitting, the government has said with approval on all levels that they will never enforce the regulations in their current form against plaintiffs like these. And we've just this week recently...
When you say in status reports, where are the...
In some other litigation, there's been a question about what the current status is, and so status reports have been submitted to the district court, which has said that with the approval of
HHS. It will never enforce. Is that because do you concede that the rule as presently written is unconstitutional?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. They'll never enforce it because there's a safe harbor which has been issued, and the departments have committed
themselves. Why did the government issue the safe harbor? In other words, your position is this rule is valid as applied to employers like the plaintiffs.
Well, Your Honor, the government issued the
safe harbor. Is that your position?
Ultimately, that is our merits position, but the government issued the safe harbor because they're trying to make an effort to address the concerns that plaintiffs like these have raised.
Isn't that a tacit admission that it's not narrowly tailored at the very least?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Obviously, the government sometimes will address concerns even if they're not constitutionally required.
Why didn't it address
the exact constitutional considerations that may have played into that.
It address the concerns, as you say, before issuing the final rule?
Well, Your Honor, as of course Your Honor is aware, there have been questions all along about how best to simultaneously provide contraceptive coverage while also addressing various concerns, including, of course, religious concerns. That was initially in the 2011 interim rule was issued. The government specifically asked to people who were making comments, look, how can we best craft a religious exception? Then they said, well, we think maybe a better route to protect a larger group of people would be to try to adjust the rule. And so the rule was then issued in 2012 with the proviso that there would be additional amendments forthcoming. And just, Judge Griffith, to answer your question, to say what's going on right now, we've spoken to the departments just this week, and we've been told that there will be an NPRM during the first quarter. And we've been told that they are still on track.
The first quarter of 2013.
That's correct. Yes, exactly. So it's currently December and January, February, and March, the first quarter. Yes, Your Honor. And that they are still on track, as they have always said that they would, to have that finalized and issued before the safe harbor expires in August, which, of course, because these plaintiffs plan years.
Would you back up to something you said a little while ago, and then a colloquy developed, and I missed it. Did you say that there have been representations made that the final order here, as we have it here, that it will never be enforced against these appellants?
I'm sorry if I was unclear about that.
Okay. You may not have been unclear, but I didn't catch it.
The representation is that they will never enforce the regulations in their present form against plaintiffs like these who are covered by the safe harbor.
What does that mean, in their present form?
Well, in other words, they expect that there will be...
The new regulations could look just like these? And that wouldn't be in its present form, is that what you mean?
Obviously, the government can't commit entirely to the substance of a rule, but...
Will they be different than these rules? You commit that they will be different.
The plaintiffs have never suggested that the government will reissue the exact same rule. Obviously, the concerns with which the plaintiffs have raised in this litigation has been the publicly declared focus of the ongoing changes.
Let me read you the language that I've been quoted to your opponent from the Federal Register, February 15th at 8727. I'm going to read it to you, and then I'm going to tell you what I think it means, and then you tell me if I'm right or wrong. It says, during the temporary enforcement safe harbor, the departments plan to develop and propose changes to these final regulations that would meet two goals. Now, I read that as saying that the replacement regulation is going to be different. It's not going to be the same as this. Am I reading that right?
I think that's certainly a fair
reading. Because you can hedge with the word plan. You know, we plan to do something.
Your Honor, that's a perfectly fair reading.
What's a perfectly fair reading? There will be a change. When this final... The new final rule comes out, it will be different in substance from this final rule.
Sure. Your Honor,
Was that a sure? That's yes?
Your Honor, I apologize. I'm not trying to be cagey. I think, obviously, the concerns which the plaintiffs have been raising have been the focus of the ongoing process. The only reason I'm just not giving a definitive yes here is, of course, as Your Honor is aware, the government, when it conducts rulemaking, is obviously required to take into account the comments that are submitted and can't, in advance of any of that, commit itself to the exact substance of the rule.
Not the exact substance, but right in here, you've committed yourself to saying there's going to be a different rule, and that makes a difference for this litigation, at least in my mind.
I think there's no reason to think that a process which is designed to address...
That's just not a good answer, and your colleague is making faces. In this case, too, I suggest you consult.
I've been told that I can say yes.
Okay.
Let me ask you something.
Faces turn out to be very helpful.
Mr. Jed, you have made representations, one, that the government will never enforce the current rule against anyone?
Against plaintiffs like these who are protected by the safe harbor.
Second, that the notice of proposed rulemaking is going to come out within the first quarter?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And third, that a final rule will issue by the summer?
By August.
By August.
Yes.
Would you have any objection to an injunction from the court holding you to each one of those representations?
We would, Your Honor.
Why?
Well, amongst other things, obviously for the court to be able to issue an injunction, there would need to be a justiciable case. And for all of the ripeness concerns, both prudential and Article 3 that we discuss, we don't think that it's within the court's power to enjoin the government's rulemaking process here. Obviously, the government is ordinarily entitled to a good faith presumption. And I should say, just to be very clear here, Your Honor, the government has, from the very beginning, said that they're trying to take into account these concerns from when it issued the interim rule to when it issued the final rule. It then said there would be an ANPRM. There is one. It has then been engaging in a process, and that process
has
been going
according to schedule. Suppose we disagreed with your standing argument and your ripeness argument. Then what would your objection be to the injunction I just described?
Your Honor, I understand your hypothetical to be if the government were to reverse the district court's justiciability questions, and I assume at that point then the case would be sent back to the district court, and then obviously the district court could decide if that sort of thing were an appropriate remedy.
Well, I don't know why it has to go, you know, it's not clear to me that There's no fact-finding that the district court can engage in. This is a judicial review of an agency rulemaking. And under Camp v. Pitts, the record is what the record is. If there's a factual problem, then it goes back to the agency, but not the district court. And we also have the complication that we have two different district judges. So instead of talking about going back to the district court, what if the injunction I just described was issued by this court?
Well, Your Honor, if I could just push back a little bit on some of those premises, it seems like the premise of issuing an injunction is assuming some merit to the ultimate merits claim, which is being raised here. And obviously, to address that, a court does need to engage in, amongst other things, certain fact findings, since ultimately there are questions about, all the standard questions that come in a RFRA action. What are the religious beliefs? What are the concerns? What are the burdens? What are the alternatives?
Why? I don't understand that, because you've just conceded you're not going to enforce this rule against these plaintiffs.
Well, but Your Honor, I would assume.
So why do you have to get into their religious beliefs or anything else?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not entirely clear on then what would justify issuing an injunction for these plaintiffs. For the plaintiffs to be able to issue
an injunction. Because you've made representations that the fact of the matter is are not binding. There's nothing that you say binds the agency. You issued a guidance document that says we're not, it's a safe harbor. There's a whole body of law in this circuit that says guidance documents are not binding. They're not law. They're like a press release, unless the agency acts in a certain way with respect to the guidance document.
Your Honor,
so what I'm suggesting to you is to get this case into the sort of an APA mold. There was at least a settlement agreement that an injunction would do the same. It would bind. It seems to me it would satisfy the plaintiff's concern. And I can't see why you would have an objection, because you've made representations to us that the form of the injunction I'm talking about would do exactly what you say you're going to do.
Your Honor, the plaintiffs here haven't sought that sort of remedy, and obviously there are a whole different sort of questions of when it's appropriate to essentially have a structural injunction regulating the rulemaking process of an agency. If the court is interested in that, we could potentially submit supplemental briefing on that question, but as far as I know, the plaintiffs haven't raised that in either the district court or
in this court. We do it in a series of cases that are loosely called TRAC. I don't know if you're aware of that whole line.
I'm aware of the TRAC cases, Your Honor. Obviously, in that sort of case, that's actually a specific claim, which is raised by the plaintiffs and is litigated from the ground up.
A claim of unreasonable delay.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And I don't understand that to be the nature of the claim which has been brought here.
Let me go back to a line of questioning I was working on before. You have now said that the rule that will come out is going to be different than the rule we have right here. But at least in the rule and in the advance notice, there's a suggestion that it's not going to be different in one very significant way, and that is that these folks don't get the exemption that churches do. That there may be some accommodation made for them, but they don't get the exemption. That seems to me a very somebody who has an exemption seems to me to be in a very different posture than someone who has an accommodation, right? Because the nature of the accommodation that's been suggested is that employees of Belmont Abbey College will be, by virtue of the fact that they have employment at the college, will be given access to these offensive devices, right? If they were exempt, the college wouldn't have to worry about that at all. And that's not going to be different, right? At the end of your new rulemaking, that is still going to be the case. Belmont Abbey is not going to be able to, Belmont Abbey employees are going to have access to this type of insurance coverage, which is so offensive to them right now. That's not going to change, is it?
So I can't speak to the exact content of what will be in the ultimate regulations, but
all I'm referring to is what is in the Federal Register, what the government has said already. That's not going to change.
Sure, but Your Honor, I did see that argument in the amicus brief that you were referring
right.
to, so if I could just offer a couple of responses
sure, please,
to that.
Yeah.
The first, of course, is obviously the plaintiffs have not pressed that argument, and indeed I think may have just entirely abandoned it when they were standing up at the podium. I'm not entirely sure.
They didn't make it. I did.
Sure. But second of all, Your Honor, if that were true, it would explain only why that one particular claim, the very last claim in their complaint, is justiciable, not the rest of it. But with regard to that one particular claim, I think there's a real question of how it's injuring them. and how a court could even start to think about how it's injuring them until it knew what the actual regulation would be which would cover them. So in other words, when I read that last claim in both plaintiffs'
But don't we know enough if we know that what the whatever the details are, the regulation is going to say employees of Belmont Abbey College, by virtue of the fact that they work at Belmont Abbey College, are going to get insurance for contraceptive and abortifacients. That, we know that's that the government said that. That's at the end of the day, it's not exactly certain how that's going to work out, but that's going to be this. That's going to be the situation, and that's noxious and offensive to them.
But for these plaintiffs to be able to pursue the claim, as I understand it, they need more than it's noxious or offensive. They need to actually be injured by it. And in the complaint, they say, and they don't flesh this out at all, I believe they allege that this makes them worse off than certain other parties. So to decide whether they're worse off, then we need to know what their situation is. And to know what their situation is, we need to know what the new rule will be and how that new rule will apply to them. And then we can compare the two. And at that point, a court could decide whether they're injured. And by the way, that comparison would also be necessary to address the merits in addition to knowing whether they're injured at all.
But this is different than American Petroleum in a fundamental way. Because in American Petroleum, the industry petitioners were getting what they wanted.
So
they were getting the spent nuclear waste that they were concerned about was not going to be regulated. There were different ways to get there, but it was not going to be regulated. And that's different here. These folks aren't necessarily. Well, they know they're not going to get what they want.
Well, that's the exemption.
Because the government's already said you're not going to get the exemption.
Well, I have two responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, as Judge Garland mentioned, in American Petroleum, obviously, there was a notice of proposed rulemaking, but there was no guarantee that that would be the actual rule that would be issued. It was just in the NPRM. But more importantly, I hate to quibble with this, but I actually think as a descriptive matter, it's not entirely true that American Petroleum was getting everything that they wanted. So the settlement agreement, which the government had entered into in American Petroleum, was actually with the Sierra Club, which obviously had a very different set of interests than the American Petroleum.
But I thought in American Petroleum, under either route that you took, the spent nuclear waste was not going to be regulated.
My understanding, Your Honor, is that, and I apologize if I'm just misremembering American Petroleum, but my understanding was that API was seeking access to a particular exemption, and the proposed rule was actually just getting rid of the exemption. Mm-hmm. And if I'm misunderstanding, I apologize, but I think the court's analysis in American Petroleum would be true either way, where the court didn't say, look, this just solves all of API's concerns. Rather, the court said it will narrow the focus. It kept using the term narrow of our legal consideration, and I think so, too, will be here.
And in AT&T and Utility Air Regulatory, they were not proposals that would. In fact, we don't know what the proposals actually were, but in AT&T, it says all they did was ask for comment in the notice on appropriate classification of the Bell operating companies. Here, there's considerably more specific than that. So it's not clear that in either, it is clear that in both of those it would have changed the legal analysis, which I take it to be your point.
Yes,
but it's not clear that it would have eliminated any argument anybody could have, which I take to be the petitioner's point here, that they're going to have an argument about the next case as well.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, ultimately, I think as Your Honor alluded to, this may very well avoid unnecessary adjudication, and at the very least, as API said, it will change the legal issues. I understand that the plaintiffs in this case may have objections to other possible rules that the government could adopt, but obviously the district court on remand cannot start engaging in an analysis of all possible rules, nor, I think, would it be appropriate essentially to issue an injunction against enforcement of the current rule when the government has already said it won't enforce the rule in its present form against
the plaintiffs. Though, in the district court here dismissed these actions, both actions, which raises a question in my mind. And API just held the case in abeyance. So there's a distinction right there, even if the cases were the same. But the question that it raises in my mind, the idea of dismissal, is, and I don't know the answer to this, maybe you do, but is there any time limit on seeking judicial review of regulations promulgated pursuant to the Affordable Care Act? I mean, most of the statutes, as you are doubtless aware, say you have to file a petition for review within 60 days or 90 days or whatever. Is there a time limit on that?
I'm not aware of whether there's a specific statutory time limit. If I could just address Your Honor's question about holding the case in abeyance, obviously, as a general matter, the government, and I assume the courts as well, don't want plaintiffs filing unripe suits just to be held in abeyance until they ripen. However, If that's something that the court was interested in, we would not have a strong objection, although I just want to just flag two issues for the court to think about if that's the direction the court is inclined to go. The first is, for a court to be able to hold the case in abeyance, obviously this is an extremely rare remedy, so courts haven't fleshed this out, but our belief is that that would be appropriate if there were a prudential ripeness problem, but if there actually weren't Article III jurisdiction, then the court probably couldn't hold on to the case. And then the second thing just to point out is, in American Petroleum, the court held the case in abeyance in the Court of Appeals because it was a direct petition for review.
All right, so the let me just ask about both of those. Those are points. Actually, three questions. So the analog here would be to direct the district court, reinstate the case, but hold it in abeyance. That would do the same, and the purpose of which would be to hold you to this schedule. And it wouldn't be quite the injunction that Judge Randolph was speaking about, but it would be status reports, this time filed with that court rather than, I don't know where these other status reports are being filed, some other courts, right? To hold you both to your commitment to the court, which I take it the government does not lightly undertake, that it will never enforce the current rule, but also to the timing questions. And that would give the petitioners a chance to go right back in without having to refile a case. And the second question you ask about whether this is prudential or jurisdictional, do you think this is jurisdictional or do you think it's prudential or do you have no idea since the line between the two is as obscure as the case law?
So the answer to all of those questions is yes, probably. Your Honor, as of course Your Honor is aware, ripeness has both a prudential
Where do you find the line?
A constitutional line. American Petroleum actually to some extent defines some of the line. I understand the Abbott Labs concerns to be more prudential and whether there is a certainly impending injury to be more Article III jurisdictional. In our view, the plaintiffs do not now and have not ever satisfied either of those, but as of course Your Honor indicates, those do overlap substantially. If I could just respond.
The underlying decision that was affirmed in Abbott Labs and Toilet Goods was written by Henry Friendly. And
who both Judge Randolph and I are fans of.
Yeah, right, yeah, for reasons we won't go into. But in his opinion, in Judge Friendly's opinion, which really is very much on point with the arguments we're hearing here, he said that the issue really isn't ripeness and the issue really isn't standing. And the situation there was there was a final rule that was clear, and the rule was going to be imposed on the people that were bringing the lawsuit. And that's usually enough to get you standing and ripeness. But he said that the issue really isn't standing and it really isn't ripeness. And then he devised the test of hardship and fitness for judicial decision at the time that was ultimately adopted in the Abbott Labs opinion by Justice Harlan. So if you take that line of cases, I don't know where the business of prudential standing came from, but whatever you call or prudential ripeness or whatever you call it, if we take those, we don't have it. In other words, we don't have an Article III problem. If you approach the case in the manner in which Toilet Goods approached it, there's not an Article III jurisdictional problem here.
Well, Your Honor, I apologize. I'm not familiar with Judge Friendly's decision in Abbott Labs.
You just lost two votes.
It was in.
And apparently, I will now be studying more Judge Friendly decisions.
It wasn't in Abbott Labs.
It's a great new biography. Yeah, we'll send it to you afterwards.
Also, going immediately on my reading list, Your Honor.
It was in Toilet Goods, not Abbott Labs.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor, in Toilet Goods. In this case, I mean, we don't think Article III is satisfied because there has not been a certainly impending injury, but we think the Abbott Labs analysis applies here in both prongs. I mean, Abbott Labs said, Judge Randolph, not only whether there's a final rule, but then separately also asked if that's tentative, also asked if it's going to be enforced, and then in that case said that the petitioners there were in a position where they were essentially forced to act or otherwise fear severe civil and criminal fines. The case here is the exact opposite. The departments have committed themselves not to enforce the rule in its present form against plaintiffs like these, and the departments are in the process of changing that rule.
I only ask you this question in the context of whether we can hold the case in abeyance, and you've made a suggestion we can't do it where there's no jurisdiction. I hate to say this, but we do this quite frequently, and so does the district court hold cases in abeyance. It doesn't decide the case, but it holds on to the case. So do you know any law for the proposition that we cannot hold a prudential ripeness case in abeyance but that we can do a prudential rightness case, but not a jurisdictional rightness case?
If I'm mistaken, Your Honor, I apologize. We were only able to locate a small number of cases in which a case has been held in abeyance, and in those cases, it appeared that there was a prudential.
This must be in our famous unpublished opinions, because we hold a lot of regulatory cases in abeyance pending.
If I could just also give one other response to your earlier question, Your Honor. If the court did feel it appropriate to send it back to a district court, obviously one potential option would then be to sort of leave it to the district court's discretion as to whether it wanted to hold the case in abeyance as compared to ordering it. Again, Your Honor, I'm not sure if...
Well, the alternative would be to uphold their dismissal, right? I mean, there's only two alternatives, so there would be no point in giving them the option since they've already dismissed.
Well, all that I'm saying, Your Honor, is there seem to be sort of three. If Your Honor agrees with the government, there would be kind of three remedial choices. One would be just to affirm. One would be, as Your Honor suggested, to send it back ordering that the case be held in abeyance. But the other possibility would be to essentially sort of vacate but affirm, say that the merits were correct, and then remand for consideration of the advance possibility.
That's say the merits were correct. You mean
– Oh, I'm sorry, that the justiciability decision was correct. That's right, Your Honor.
Right.
Do you have an answer to the allegation that the mandate, the contraceptive mandate, at least to the extent it's requiring coverage for morning after and week after pills, is a violation of the Section 1303 of the Affordable Care Act, which prohibits abortions?
I do not, Your Honor. That's a merits issue, which hasn't been presented by this case, and we're not prepared to address it.
Maybe.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So it may be presented by the case.
Yes, that may be presented by this case. That's correct. Unless there are any other questions.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we give the petitioner 4 minutes here of rebuttal time. You can see how carefully we police this clock.
May it please the court. So let me address abeyance very quickly. It would be strange to order abeyance in this case because it's a weaker case we have a far stronger case for ripeness than was presented in API.
I hate to say this. If you hadn't suggested it in your reply brief, I would not have thought of it.
Well,
so sometimes suggesting a fallback, I know you're not going to you're calling it a fallback, but I would never have thought of it if you hadn't suggested it.
Well, it's governing precedent from this court in the only case that even comes close to the procedural posture. Here you have a stronger case for ripeness, and but let's talk about it. So if that were such a thing, it's a little bit more complex than this, because it's just Judge Griffith, as you suggest, there are claims here that by the very terms of the ANPRM are just as ripe now as they will be next quarter. Claims under the Establishment Clause, certain claims under the Free Exercise Clause, certain claims under the APA. What sense would it make to hold those claims in abeyance since they couldn't possibly be affected by the ANPRM that I've just heard the government talk about?
I didn't read that argument in your brief.
We say all of the claims are ripe.
Argument that there would be no difference in the analysis under the ANPRM as compared to under the existing rule. I don't remember the argument.
Look, the reason we're not making that argument in the brief because we're not challenging the APRM. That would fall into the government's trap of saying we're challenging something that doesn't exist.
Complicated strategy.
If we're being forced to challenge some phantom ANPRM, and we've just heard the government commit to something in next quarter, but that ANPRM will still have the mandate and still have the exemption, then it can't possibly be the case that all of the claims are unripe. So the other point is, would discovery be able to proceed under the case being held in abeyance? That'd be a great hardship not to be able to hold the government's feet to the fire, because discovery is going to reveal things that are going to be relevant to the final rule now and to
What kind of discovery, other than jurisdictional discovery, which is available in every case, but what kind of discovery
intentional discrimination under the Free Exercise Clause? That's the only claim that we think is a discovery.
Intentional discrimination?
What would that discovery look like? What do you mean?
Seeing the communications between the HHS and the IOM, and seeing if they're deliberately targeting religious organizations, which is one of the claims we make.
I wonder whether now you're falling into their trap, because now there would be fact issues, not just law issues, but fact issues, and that is even more classic ripeness problem.
But Your Honor, with all due respect, we're not falling
into the
trap.
You don't want to make that
argument. I'm responding to these suggestions from the court.
I know, but if you're making an argument that this case really could turn in part on facts, you're digging a hole that you probably don't want to dig.
Well, that's true.
You understand the problem,
yes,
right?
Yes, I understand the problem. The vast majority.
I want to warn you, just let you know
the vast majority
put up
claims,
a flag for you.
Look, the vast majority of the claims are legal claims, right?
That's what
RFRA, most of the First Amendment claims, the APA claims, mostly legal claims. I'm just saying, abeyance creates a hardship. Here's another hardship that abeyance would create. Come January 1st, we're exposed to ERISA lawsuits. Under Chamber of Commerce versus EPA, that is enough to create rightness and standing.
But under Chamber of Commerce, what happened is, there's a weird statute. Maybe this is a weird statute too, but it allowed private parties to force the FEC to enforce. That's not what this one does. And all you get in an ERISA lawsuit here is repayment of benefits. You don't get penalties.
Injunctive relief.
Yes. And
to include the benefits.
Yeah. But not what was available in the other case, which were pretty massive penalties. And here, and also that was only a standing case. There was no argument about ripeness in that case. So the government's argument is, if that happens, and of course, we don't know whether it's going to happen. You can defend there. You can make exactly the same defense there that you would make here. And if it would have won here, presumably it would have won there. I'm talking about the merits.
Right. Isn't that
an appropriate answer to the problem with respect to the risk of those lawsuits?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I mean, It seems to us that Congress deliberately invoked ERISA in the Affordable Care Act for some reason. It must be that this would create pressure to conform to the Affordable Care Act. So Congress can't possibly be allowed to put that pressure on someone and not have an Article III court review it.
You say put that pressure. Is your point that as of January 1, there's going to be a new cause of action in the land? A cause of action,
yes,
under ERISA against?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes. It's
because that's when the
That's right.
That's when the final rules kick in.
Well, no, Your Honor. The fines kick on January 1st, 2014. The ERISA lawsuits kick in 2 weeks.
Right.
Right? And the government is specifically...
And that's a cause of action that doesn't exist today.
Does not exist
today.
Exist
then. Now, but Judge Garland's right. I mean, the defenses to that ERISA, they're the same defenses, the same arguments you would be making here, but...
Well, true, but subjecting someone to the threat of lawsuits, mm-hmm, or even having to go into court and make defenses has got to be an Article III injury. Mm-hmm. And it's coming down the road very, very soon.
So if you are... And in fact, do I remember the record correctly that you represent Wheaton or Belmont Abbey?
Both, Your Honor.
Both, okay. Well, I'm talking about in the lower court. I can't...
Both, Your Honor.
Okay. There were 8 complaints filed against Wheaton College by employees.
Belmont Abbey, Your Honor.
Or was it Belmont Abbey? Okay. 8 complaints filed, and they were filed claiming what? It was EEOC complaints?
That's correct. EEOC complaints that denial of contraceptive coverage was gender discrimination. They've been resolved, and that interpretation by EEOC has been rejected by at least one circuit court already.
So that, I mean, it's not fanciful that you'd be subjected to suits, because Belmont Abbey has already been subjected to 8 of them even before this law kicked in.
Not at all. Not at all fanciful. It's not required that we predict that they will happen. But the point is they put pressure on the First Amendment and RFRA rights right now. These harms are going to go unaddressed as of January 1st.
And there would be nothing to prevent a district court from wherever would it be, North Carolina? For Belmont Abbey?
Well, District of Columbia.
Oh, okay. But there would be nothing to prevent...
Well, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Yeah,
you mean if the lawsuit were brought.
Right. It would be, what, North Carolina?
North Carolina, that's
okay.
Correct.
So nothing to prevent a district court from enjoining you to comply with the current law.
Absolutely not.
But also nothing to prevent the district court from agreeing with you and enjoining the government from declaring the regulation unconstitutional, right?
That's true, but we still have to be in court defending it.
In court here. I mean, I suppose expenses, I don't know which lawyers are more expensive, but...
surely not us.
You're very good. Well, you're very good. But I assume you'll defend them there, too.
No doubt. But, however, the pressure caused by the prospect of the lawsuits is a pressure on their religious liberty, among other things. It's
not if you get a preliminary injunction. It's the same. You want the same injunction here that you would get there.
That's true. And that leads me to the other point about an abeyance. So an abeyance plus a preliminary injunction, yes.
No, I mean not if you get an injunction there, not if you get...
That's true.
You know, right. Okay, I think now we're almost 10 minutes over. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Excellent argument on both sides. We'll take the matter under submission.